At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm Tony Bruschi. Welcome. We hope you've enjoyed our coverage on the trial of Alec Murdaugh. This is a look back at some of the key moments and conversations that we've had over the last several weeks regarding the case.
This is a podcast that seeks justice. Justice for the lives stolen by those in society that hide amongst us every day. Hidden in our towns, cities, and countrysides, the places that we work, and sometimes in our very own homes. This is Hidden Killers.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for joining us. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our discussions on the cases that we are following for you. Larry Uretzian, criminal defense attorney, is with us today to talk about the Alec Murdaugh trial. The defense has fought the admissibility of evidence in the murder case as strong as they could over the last week or so, asserting that the financial fraud cases that Alec has been involved in are irrelevant to the question of Murdaugh's guilt in the murders of his wife and son. It's understandable to argue that if you're the defense attorney for Alec Murdaugh. Larry Uretzian, as a criminal defense attorney, your thoughts?
On the face of it, they do have a valid point. They have to make that argument. I mean, if I was defense counsel, I'm going to want that kind of evidence out. You don't want it to come in and complicate things. It almost gives the prosecution their motive. It's one more reason, but then I can see the prosecution argument, right? Defense is saying this has, you know, the fraud has nothing to do with the alleged murders. What does one have to do with the other? And then the prosecution is going to say, no. We think they're all connected. You know, everything was blown up in his face. And, you know, the day before the shootings, he was confronted about the fraud. Mm-hmm. And you know what? He may have hit a low in his life. And that got him to the point of deciding, or maybe speeding up, whatever it is, the shootings and the murder of his wife and his son.
In this case, it does seem to connect, especially now that we know the dates of how some things went down with the confrontation at the law office for his financial misdeeds. And then suddenly, within 24 hours, this happens. Is that more than just a coincidence, in your opinion?
Well, that's definitely an argument that the prosecution is going to try to make. And the way they're going to portray it is it cannot be a coincidence. A jury is going to decide that. It's a factual issue. And then the jury can decide what they can infer from that. You're being confronted about over $792,000 of embezzled money from clients. And the next day, your wife and your son are shot and dead. I mean, you know that the judge is going to allow them to make that argument. They have to. Yeah. It's part of the prosecution case. It goes to the motive. I understand why the defense is doing what they're doing. They are advocates for their client. They have to try and keep this out. Now, are they going to win this one? Most likely not.
Yeah, I mean, it really does paint a very dark picture. And whether or not the two are truly connected or not, just the impression and the painting of this reckless, self-indulged character of Murdaugh to the jury is obviously not a positive thing for the defense of Alec Murdaugh. But again, it also does not necessarily make him a killer per se. But to have that sort of character painted out there, have you seen this in other cases? And how does that typically affect a jury when other crimes are introduced? Maybe not 100% surely connected, but more of a context of this individual is introduced.
Of course, it's damning. It's not helpful at all. You want to portray your client as a defense attorney. You want to portray your client as as a good person, right? Mm-hmm. And anytime anyone alleges fraud, it goes directly to the credibility of that client, right? And a trial is all about credibility. So of course it's not helpful. And of course it's going to negatively impact the defense case. And that's why they're going to fight it tooth and nail. And I also understand where they're coming from. They're going to say, listen, the prejudicial impact of just coming in is highly outweighs any relevance this may have to the case. But again, I don't know all the details, and we don't know all the details here. And I'm sure the prosecution has more of that, and so does the defense. And they're going to battle it out. And the judge is going to make the decision of, you know, what's more important here? Mm-hmm. If it's so relevant that it's really a huge part of the prosecution case, then it's going to come. But if it's tangential and the prejudicial effect is so negative and so bad, then the judge can say, you know what, we're going to keep this out. Any probative value that you're going to get out of this prosecution is far outweighed by the prejudice in this case. And that's something they can always argue. But it's looking like it's coming in anyway.
It is.
The way I've seen it. So the judge has already made up his mind, and he must think that this is a huge part of the prosecution case. And it tends, the probative part is there. It makes it more likely that he killed his wife and his son because of the troubles he was going through.
How does the defense combat that type of evidence when it comes out that just seems so damning? How do you change the mind of a jury or after you learn this about the individual in question and somehow make them feel differently?
You know, there's always ways of doing that. It all depends on the evidence involved. If yes, maybe he was confronted, but he really wasn't at fault. He truly had an embezzled. And again, I don't have all the details.
Sure.
Maybe one had nothing to do with the other, right? He loved his wife. Okay, he's facing financial woes and troubles, but do people kill their wives and their children because of that? Unless there's a mental health issue. And then if there is such a thing, I don't know, again, if this defense is going to come in with something of that sort. I don't know what's at their disposal, but there's always, if there's a mental health issue or whatever has happened, or if there's evidence that that he truly wasn't the one, if they've got a defense for the murder, mm-hmm. other than just the motive that they've got, if they've got a defense, I mean, whether it be an alibi witness or the forensics just don't tell a different story, right?
Yeah.
Whatever it may be, whatever their defense is, that can be brought in to bolster the defense position and to attack this kind of evidence by the prosecution. And by the way, the prosecution doesn't necessarily need motive; it's not an element. Mm-hmm. But motive is what jurors are always looking for.
Like, sure.
Why did this person kill these individuals? If he had no motive, then it's harder for them to buy the prosecution story, right?
Mm-hmm. What do you make of the body language that Alec Murdaugh has been portraying in court as various things have been coming out?
So give me a couple of examples of this body language.
Sure.
I can tell.
When they have been talking about, and they even showed photographs of the crime scene of his dead wife and his son, in very, you know, graphic detail of what happened, very just kind of stoic there, almost as if he was looking at the Taco Bell menu. But when it came to, information that directly contradicted, some of his claims of where he was and when, specifically the video that was released, in the dog kennel of his son and his wife, and then Alec's voice can be heard on that as well. He had already claimed that he was visiting his mother, who had Alzheimer's at that moment in time, but there he is, time-stamped at a location that he wasn't. He's staring at the ground, rocking back and forth, almost like a nervous child would be doing when confronted with the information or about a lie. It was kind of surprising to me just seeing some of that behavior that almost looked somewhat incriminating in court,
right,
with the rocking back and forth.
Well, I mean, the worst, listen, generally defense attorneys will tell their clients who are in the middle of a trial to try and look stoic, right? You don't want to show your emotions one way or the other, no matter what it is. Mm-hmm. Don't react. Try not to react, because guess what? Everyone is watching you, and especially the jury is watching you, every single move you make. And just like you've made a note of the way he's behaving and his reactions, the jury is doing the same, because body language is a huge part of deciding, you know, who's credible, right? Mm-hmm. And they do the same with witnesses. So if he was stoic, if you just said, Laura, he was stoic when they were showing his son's photos and his wife's photos and the, you know, murder scene and this and that, I would have said, you know what, as long as he keeps that same stoicism, it's all across the board, then I would understand it. It would be fine. But if he's reacting to other things, then you start wondering what's going on. And that's a lot more telling. And yes, it is problematic. You don't need me to tell you that.
Sure. I was just surprised with his knowledge of all this, being a defense attorney, that he was even acting these ways. He doesn't even need an attorney to tell him not to do this. He should know this.
He should know this, but remember, he's a human being and he's under a lot of stress. And when we're under a lot of stress, we're not thinking about people watching us. After a while, you forget, right? Mm-hmm. It's human nature. I mean, you've got people watching you, and after a while, you become comfortable and you start reacting, forgetting that they're still watching you. They haven't stopped. And that's just a human part of it. And look, you're saying he's an attorney and he should have known better, but look at the mess he's in.
Sure, that's true. Could they just give him a kitten and let him sit there and pet it all day? I think that might be his only chance at this point. Look at the man. He's petting a kitten. He can't be guilty.
Or they could do, give him a pad and he can just draw, which is what Johnny Depp did, and it worked. So that's what they could do.
Crayons and a kitten, and that's how Alec gets free.
Maybe. We'll have to see.
Larry Uretsian, criminal defense attorney, thank you for your insights, as always, into this case. Very, very much appreciated. That's what we have for you for right now. You can follow us wherever you download podcasts. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and discussions on the cases that we're following for you. You can get a complete list of those cases and their respective channels in the description of this episode. You can even get a commercial-free experience when you sign up through Apple Podcasts. You can even try it for 3 days free right now. You can follow me on Twitter @TonyBPod. I'm Tony Bruschi. For all of us here, thanks for listening.